You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is March 21st, 2024, 7:36 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And what I thought I would talk about tonight is something that's been coming up in my work with people, but also it's something that resonates with me because of the way that I was brought up. But what do you do when you grow up in a family where your mother doesn't really like you? It's surprising to me the number of times that that comes up in the work that I do with people and how it creates this pattern of experience. And when we look at it through an attachment lens, the first person that you choose to be the model for everything is the person that really has the most influence in creating the way that we experience ourselves in the world. And it is so pernicious, as my friend Stas says, it's so pernicious in terms of the way that it informs everything. We grow up in a culture in the West with this idea, this ideal of a mother's love for her child. And when you look at the biology of it, actually, it only lasts for a couple of months, and it's largely hormonal in the beginning. I recognize that this is a touchy subject, so I'm going to be a little bit light about it, if that is okay. So you have that initial influence of the mother's body who's given birth, driving lactation and driving the need to take care of the child. And children, you know, are motivated. I don't know if you know this or not, but if you put a newborn infant on the belly of the mother, the infant will actually crawl up the mother's body or creep up the mother's body looking for the breast, the sustenance that comes from that. But so there's this instinctual period in early childhood, early infancy. When we begin to build a working model of ourselves and also of the world, it's in some sense a blank slate. We don't know how to do anything. We're born prematurely. If you look at the rest of the animal kingdom, you know, a great ape infant from the time they're born has the physical strength to hold on to their mother so that she can move them across the Serengeti. But human babies can't even sit up. They can't even roll over. Have you been around an infant? They're entirely dependent on who comes to them and how that person responds to them in order to understand the world. The evolutionarists think that the reason for this is because a fully developed human brain would be too large to pass through the birth canal. But I noticed in the literature that there's some rumblings that might not be actually what's happening. So it's hard to know. That isn't with science so much that it tells you exactly what's happening. It tells you what we think is happening now. And then each time we come up with something else that's clarifying, we change the models. So an infant just presents not understanding what the need is, not understanding what will satisfy the need, not having language, not having the capacity to understand. I'm going to close the door. And then somebody responds. I know it was very surprising to me when I first picked up on this, but the first thing that a child does to get attention is not to cry. The first thing that a child does to get attention is look as cute as they possibly can. So imagine that little baby with that smile. And it's not triggered on anyone in specific, it's triggered on motion. So if something moves in front of the gaze of an infant, they light up with a sense of smile, a sense of cuteness to elicit a response from somebody. And then if somebody comes, it doesn't go beyond that cute stage. But if they don't come, there's a kind of confusion. And if you pay attention to small children, say a 3-year-old child, when they make a signal for attention, do you know what it is? Typically, they put their arms up and out like this. Come pick me up. And if a secure child just tends to put their arms up because their expectation is that somebody's coming, if they make that signal, because that's their experience of the world. And if you had that experience, there's a sense of safety, a sense of security in that. You don't worry about whether or not somebody's going to take care of you. You don't have to explain to yourself why nobody comes or they don't take care of you in the way that you need. But if they don't come, you look bewildered, and you can see that on a 3-year-old's face when they're eliciting a gesture for care, and it's not satisfied right away. And then that confusion turns into a painful experience, which is often expressed as a whimper. Have you ever been at a party with a bunch of small kids? Just the volume of all of those kids running around screaming, and you're in a circle talking to the parents, and all of a sudden one of them interest is piqued because they hear in that sound, that wall of sound, the sound of their child because they know it so well, and they go and they seek them out. And if they get them at that point, it's just a whimpering, or an intermittent cry is next, and then a continuous cry, and then a tantruming. If you're been around small kids and you know how to take care of them, you know that if the kid gets to tantrum mode, it's going to take 20 or 30 minutes of soothing them to get them to calm down, because that's how long it takes the liver and kidneys to filter out all those neurotransmitters, all that energy. So you want to get there earlier, so it doesn't take so long, so it's not so resource intensive, so the child is happier. But in that infant's gaze, and a child's depth of focus is about 6 inches or so, so that anything that's further away than that, they don't really see very well, and they don't see color yet. So it's this stark map of the face of the caregiver that actually is the whole world for a small child. And it's that reflection back from that face in how we begin to create the working model of ourselves. And also, what's very important is the expectation of what the world has to offer us. So you make the expression, the caregiver responds to that, they attune to you, they empathetically connect to you. That is to say, they feel into you to understand what's actually happening with you. They mirror back their trial understanding of what that is. So in the facial expression, let's say they think that you're sad, they make a sad face. And then you begin to connect that facial expression with the physical sensations that you're feeling in the moment. And then the caregiver will attempt to meet your needs. And if they meet your needs, having an interesting experience of the system raising hands that don't seem to be raised. That's why I paused. So, if the parents meet your needs, then you begin to associate your expression with the kind of care that you. So, you make an expression, the caregiver attunes to you, empathetically connects to you, mirrors back to what they think is going on with you, and then they take care of you. And when you learn that cycle, then what you begin to know is if I do this, I'll get that response. That's the circle of security. Of course, we do that with people as adults in our relationships. We make a signal of what kind of care we want, and if they're paying attention to us and they know what that means and they're responsive to us, they'll respond to us and take care of us in the way that we need. Understand that you as an infant do not have the capacity to understand the state of the caregiver that is providing care for you. And so if the caregiver that you've chosen is overwhelmed by the experience of taking care of you, they're reflecting a lot of information back to you. And people come to understand and create these working models of self that are based on that dyadic relationship with the caregiver very early on, way before autobiographical memory sets in, way before language sets in, way before there's a way of interpreting what's happening. If the caregiver is overwhelmed, often what can happen is that you have a sense that you're too needy, you're too demanding. John Bowlby famously said, you're only as needy as your unmet needs. And so children who are needs are attended to and cared for tend to settle in. It really is about meeting, you're having the experience of your needs being met well enough. And when you look at the attachment literature, the level is astonishingly low. 30% of the time or better is what's required for secure attachment. And so if you don't have secure attachment, you have insecure, disorganized attachment, what you're talking about is a childhood experience that was quite harsh. Even though when we grow up in family systems, because it's always that way, or at least most of the time, it's con from the transition between a no a conscious representation of the self experience and the conscious experience of self. The reaction is similar. So you have a challenged caregiver whose resources are exceeded. So it isn't that your needs are extraordinary or that you're too demanding or that the needs, you're too sensitive. Often with addiction, there's a correlation between sensitivity, an exceptionally sensitive child and the environment. None of that actually is what's happening. What's happening is that the caregiver can't meet the needs of the child, so that they become the needs become unmet, and often they're characterized by the family system as being extraordinary needs, but it's a child's need for adult care, usually pretty ordinary. Can you remember in your early childhood and scenes that would indicate to you how old you were in the scene? This is also a reflection of the experience of the relationship with the caregiver. I started off by saying, what happens to kids whose caregivers don't really like them? If you haven't been around mothers or fathers contemplating the arrival of their first child, it's very ordinary to have a conversation of, what if I don't like my kid when they come? To which I usually respond, you have to love them, even if they're a Republican. That's not what you get to pick, who the child is who arrives, right? And then your job as a caregiver is to investigate who this child is and to support this child in developing themselves so that they have the full capacity of who they are in the world. And some people get very hung up on the genetics of it. Some people get very hung up on the nature of the child, whether it will be easy to relate to them. But because it is an unknowable, right? You're not picking somebody who's already formed. The child presents themselves, and your obligation to the child is to take care of them the best way that they need. Did you hear me? The best way that they need. I had an argument with my dad in my teenage years, and he said, I don't know what you're complaining about. I gave you the childhood I always wanted. To which I said, but what did that have to do with me? Because it certainly wasn't useful to me as a person, what he was offering. And he felt it was necessary to direct me. And so the way that in my upper middle class family was, he would pay for the things that he thought you should do, and he wouldn't pay for the things that he didn't think you should do, which meant you either did the things he wanted to do or you didn't do the other things. Later on, I would hitchhike. This was, in the 60s when you could still do that. Let me let the dog out. With my dad, I didn't get the sense that he liked me much, but I also didn't get the sense that he was particularly interested, which is a different thing, a disinterest. And what I was wanting to focus on more was the dislike, or and in the extreme form, an active dislike. And if you grow up in a family system like that, what you notice is that there's a constant flow of criticism that comes to you and a constant direction to be different than you are. One of the things that's important to understand about childhood and the dependency that we have on the people that take care of us is the power differential is so great that we always fold. We always abandon ourselves, and we always do our best to become the thing that they want, the person that they want. And so often what we have the experiences of is developing this sense of being that actually doesn't match who we are very well. So we have low investment in the presentation that we're constantly having to make in order to get along in the family system. But that piece gets developed. We get good at that. The piece that's missing for us, and the thing that doesn't really get developed, is our authentic self, that expression of what actually matters to us, what actually we find meaning in. And this is a dilemma, particularly as you get move into adolescence and youth, and then into your adult life. Developing the skill set that is in line with what the family system demands of you, and not developing the sense of your authentic self, means that you don't have an understanding of what actually is that meaningful to you. And so you don't put resources into finding that and satisfying that. And that leads to a quality of despair at being alive. Addiction is one of the things that can happen in this kind of environment. And the reason that that happens is because primarily neglect. When you have a caregiver that doesn't particularly care for the child that they have, they don't take care of them. They're not involved enough in the life of the child. And that neglect creates a terrible sadness. One of the things that the cohort that I deal with that has these issues is at the core this terrible sadness. And it's often coupled with a passivity. When you consider what actions you might take, you end up in this sad place where no action seems to be workable. And the reason for this is that in childhood, you try everything you can to get the caregiver to take care of you, to delight in you, to appreciate you, to adore that spontaneous, authentic expression of you, and nothing works. And so dismissing people, and disorganized people begin to suppress awareness of their emotions. In humans, emotion is one of the necessary components to translate short-term memory into long-term memory. So you'll notice in one group of people who have this experience, an absence of memory of early childhood, an absence of memory of mid-childhood. Really, it isn't until puberty that the memory processes begin to make that bridge. There's often a suppression of emotion, of conscious awareness of emotion. There's a suppression of the sensations in the body, so there's a kind of a numbing and cutoff experience of it. The experience of over and over again being presented with a caregiver that doesn't like you is so unbearable that you simply stop feeling in response. And then when you come into the adult life, of course, you've created a roadmap of who you are, and you've created a roadmap of what you can expect from the world. And that roadmap is informed by this constant rejection. And so our anticipation in this conundrum is that the world will be rejecting and that there's nothing that we can do about that. There's no action that we can take, no presentation that we can give that will change that. So that is the conundrum. But then we might look at what it is that one can do to begin to remedy this. Some people, more organized people, tend to develop strategies that keep them from experiencing any of these difficult emotions. So they're often inflating, grandiose, braggadocious. And they pursue things that provide status so that they can present themselves in the way that they were trained to do in that development of the false self so that they can appear to be a desirable a person that would be interesting. Disorganized people can't really pull it together to do that, and depending on whether you're more on the avoidance side or on the preoccupied side, of the chaotic, intense emotions that arise from that kind of experience are mainly what's going on. The reason that addiction is so high in the disorganized community is because the management of those emotional states, which you were supposed to learn from your caregiver, you didn't learn because they didn't take care of you. They didn't teach you how to do it. And so, and because you have this conviction that if people get to know your authentic self, they will be rejecting, you tend to move toward externalized systems for regulation, which include substances and processes. So part of this is the willingness to change your mind about other people and offer the opportunity for people to get to know you, which means you have to be willing to present authentically. And in the beginning, this is really a challenging thing because you have this very polished, very developed, false sense of who you are. And even when you turn yourself inward toward the authentic experience of you, it's this underdeveloped, not necessarily skillful way of being in the world. So, you know, hopefully there's some capacity to migrate the skill set that you learned and developed in the false self toward the authentic self, but this very vulnerable process of beginning to express the authentic self so that people can meet the needs of the authentic self and you can begin this process of feeling seen, feeling known, and feeling safe in being seen and known. Is that making sense? One of the things that need to happen is the development of emotional regulation skills so that you can begin to manage the chaotic internal experience of the disorganized person. And in the dismissing person. The reason I talk about avoidant strategies mainly in this conundrum is because that's what happens to people who are in this circumstance. Dismissing people need to allow emotional awareness of their emotional lives into consciousness. They need to be able to sit into the terrible sadness. Disorganized people need to sit into the terrible sadness and allow the intensity of it without needing to get away from it. That is a lot of change that happens. And then the examination of how you regulate your emotions. In Buddhism, we talk about this process of converting ultimate reality into conceptual reality. And this is also an area of tension and also an area of challenge. We have the capacity to sense something. We have an object that can be sensed when there's contact. A consciousness of the sensing experience arises. It's evaluated for urgency. Does it need immediate attention? Does it not matter? Is there time for a pleasant experience? And then it's compared to the perceptual database, these working models of self and world. And when you grow up in infancy and toddlerhood and childhood with this caregiving environment that doesn't welcome and celebrate you, that doesn't delight in you, then the whole database is stacked to create reality that is like that. So over and over again, you create these experiences of the self being unwanted and the world is being harsh or rejecting. How do you reorganize that? So what we really need to do is pay attention over and over again to the way that we create the world. And it really is at a foundational level that this happens. So there really is the need for an exploration to find solutions. In the Buddhist idea of this, of course, the conceptual reality that we create is based on meaning, the meaning of the experience that we're having, not on what's happening. The Pali word for this is called tajapanadi, which means the constant checking that the reality that you've created actually matches the data that's coming in, the sense data that's coming in. This is what I'm sensing. This is what I've made. This is what I'm sensing. This is what I've made. This is what I'm sensing. This is what I've made. And shifting from that non-mentalizing perspective of this is what I'm sensing. This is the reality I've made. So that's what must be happening. To this is what I think is going on. What do you think is going on? This is what this means to me. What does it mean to you? Coming into that center of understanding that because your conditioning is different from everybody else's, and everybody else's conditioning is different from you, everybody is going to have a different point of view about what's happening. And one of the things that's so marvelous about intimate relationships is that point of view creates, that varying points of view creates depth of understanding. I'm seeing this, and this is what it's meaning to me. You're seeing that and sharing an awareness of what's happening, but it means something different to you because your conditioning is. And then if you've been in relationship for a long time, of course, you have so many markers that are shared. There's a richness that can come in the assigning of meaning that's also linked into the experience of the relationship that you have. One of the things about secure relationships, when you get into them, is that they're stable and they're long-lasting, typically. And one of the characteristics of insecure and disorganized attachment is that they're volatile and often short-lived, at least in comparison to the quality of secure functioning relationships. Is that all making sense so far? One of the hardest things to begin to do as an adult when you begin to sense that you grew up in an environment where you weren't appreciated, you weren't valued, is to find the way to see yourself as valuable, to see yourself as desirable. In the ideal parent figure meditation, there's often an instruction, which is the ideal parent figure's delight in the expression of your authentic self. And people who have the experience of being disliked as children often find that an impossible thing to imagine. And that points to another aspect of that, is that we begin to limit our capacity to imagine these things. We find it completely unbelievable that somebody would delight in this. We find it completely unbelievable that someone would value us. And we don't know how to respond to it. It's hard to imagine what being delighted in would feel like, because it seems so remote. But really what that's pointing to is the limitation in our imaginations. In childhood, one of the ways that we regulate disappointing experiences is we stop imagining that we could have that. But doesn't come up in the representations that we make. So in this moment, you choose what's happening, and that ties the next moment to the possibilities that could come from what you've just chosen. And then in the next moment, what opens up is the full range of possibilities that you could choose in the next moment. But as soon as you pick one, they all drop away except for the one that you picked. And that's how you get onto these vicious cycles. You get onto these virtuous cycles. What happens when you limit your imagination is that you don't have the clarity to see the full range of choices that are in front of you. Often you have a very restricted view of what's possible. And so you choose over and over again these possibilities that create these patterns of repetition in you. When you don't believe that people will take care of you, when you don't believe that people are trustworthy, when you don't believe that people have an interest in you, then you restrict your relationships. But in restricting your relationships, you also restrict the main way that human beings emotionally regulate. You restrict the main way that human beings feel safe. And this world is a very frightening, chaotic, unpredictable place. And without that sense of safety, it's hard to navigate. One of the things that people who have this experience of being disliked in childhood, and I most people, if they have the option of a mother, pick mother as the primary caregiver. So we talk about it in that way. If you restrict yourself to the point that you won't rely on anyone else, then you really are confining yourself to external sources for emotional regulation that are not people-based, which is one of the reasons why substances and processes are so common in this group. I'm not going to rely on anybody because they're not reliable and they don't like me anyway. There's nothing I can do to make myself likable. I'm going to have to go it alone, and I'm going to have ways of making my way through the world that don't require me to count on anyone. And we need to change our mind about that. Because you had a caregiver that was not responsive to you does not mean that you are not likable. One of the things that I think I notice both in myself and also the people I work with is that that is so painful that and so difficult to understand that we go into a kind of confused state. It's a way of relating to it. And that confused state makes it very hard to navigate the world the way that it is. So to come into this understanding of our value and our capacity to be delightful, our capacity to delight in other people, and reorganize around relationship that will actually support us in the pursuit of things that we find meaningful, but really touching into that, the nature of your authentic interest, your authentic talent, your authentic capacity, and then putting around yourself people who will encourage that. That's the way out of this. Changing the working model of self, changing the working model of the world so that we're not expecting indifference or rejection, but anticipating that some people will like us. Not everybody, of course. This is not a universal, but some people do. And if we present ourselves authentically, of course, the people that are interested in that come forward. The main difficulty of continuing life outside of the family system, using the strategies of the family system and presenting yourself inauthentically, is that the people who like the inauthentic self come forward. And that reinforces the idea that your authentic self is not likable, because you're not actually presenting the opportunity for people to meet you there. You're continuing to reinforce the notion you have to pretend to be someone else. Is that making sense? I'm not sure the sadness of that goes away. It's a piece of it. Is, you know, that the desire of the child to look at the caregiver's face and have the caregiver's face light up, express that sense of delight, and then that you would not have had that is that sadness. But you didn't. And so the sadness is warranted. But it doesn't mean that you can't find somebody now who will. I think that's that first piece of changing your mind about that. I'm going to move away from the people that aren't interested in me toward the people that are interested in me. I'm going to move toward the sense of being delightful and delighted in. I'm going to move toward the people that encourage that expression. I'm going to pursue the things that are meaningful to me. And I'm going to find that the satisfaction of doing that. How's that? Too bleak? I wish there was an easier way around this. I wish there was an explanation for it that would change something. In one of the paths is to see your caregivers clearly and to understand what the conditions were for them at that time and why they were so overwhelmed by the experience of taking care of you. And to know really deeply that it isn't that they had it to give you and didn't offer it to you because they didn't think there was something right about you that you deserved it. It's that they didn't have to give it. You didn't get it because of something that you did or didn't do or some way you were or weren't. It's that thing that we all need in that process of developing wasn't available. Still doesn't mean it's not completely heartbreaking. It still is. But you didn't fail. That's helpful. And you don't have to do it anymore. That's the good news. You can do something different. So what do you think? Loving kindness or insight practice? Let's settle into this. It's like all participatory democracy. It's settled by one vote because everybody else abstains. All right. I'm going to default to loving kindness because it's so touchy, this idea. That deep, deep longing to have been the joy of your caregiver and that recognition that didn't happen. So go ahead and settle in. All right, let go of the meditation. How'd that go? Good enough?
Yeah, that was very relaxing, very peaceful.
Oh, good. Yep. You do enough of that practice and everything is beautiful. It really is astonishing how you just create everything with such a profound sense of beauty to it. There may be a little grumbling getting there.
I didn't fall asleep this time.
Lovely.
As relaxing as it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah, that deep sense of ease is lovely. So in April, on all four Saturdays, we're doing a level one, so 9 to 1. is that. You can sign up for that if you want to get into the attachment stuff. I'm going to be going for 5 weeks beginning on May 7th. So there'll be no class between May 7th and the week of June 17th. I'm doing a 15-day retreat in Poland. You're welcome to come to, and then also a 4-day non-residential retreat in Utrecht. When I get back in June, we're going to do a series of meditation and addiction courses, and we're going to offer for the first time in a virtual format the meditation and addiction level 2. We've only offered that before in rehabs, and I thought maybe we would try to do it virtually. The meditation and addiction level 2 is an hour of class 3 times a week for 12 weeks, so it's an intensive, but we think in the addiction community, shorter and more frequent is actually a good model. We have noticed in the past that the 2-week interval is actually too much for engagement. So the first on Monday and Wednesday and Friday from 6 to 7 in the evening, the Monday is a didactic, the Wednesday is a meditation instruction, and the Friday is a processing group. I'm excited about that. It would be nice to be able to offer this in a wider arena. And then we will also do a level 2 as well, meditation and attachment level 2. You come out of the level 1 courses and go into the level 2 courses. If you have addiction issues, both process and substances, and it's not quite stabilized, we would suggest you go into the level 2 addiction. But if the addiction piece of your recovery is pretty well managed, then to go into the attachment side is a good idea, because the underlying cause we think of addiction is attachment disturbances. And we want to funnel everybody who's interested in doing the attachment repair into that general community, whether you have addiction or you don't. I think that's about covering the rest of the first half of the year. The second half of the year is still up in the air. We'll see what happens. We did put out a new website, so if you want to take a look at it, there is also a resource on that, which is I made a 30-minute video on the cycle of understanding what attachment is and attachment repair, which is available on that. There's also an explanation of the different levels of engagement that we have. I offer the teaching freely, but I do hope if you're resourced and are able to make a contribution, you will. There's a link for donation on the website. Help support me and also the work that Metagroup is doing. Really appreciate your practice. Thank you, and we'll see you soon. Bye.
Thank you, George.
Thank you.